Live from the Bay of Pigs, this is Austin Danger Podcast, now and forever the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. I'm Kevin. As always, I'm joined by super producer extraordinaire Mackenzie Wilkes.
Hello.
You know, Kenzo, you never really know how an episode of Austin Danger Podcast is going to start, but this one's going to start like this. Tonight, we will be discussing our latest randomly curated film, Joe Dante's tribute to the B-movies of his childhood and the reflection of the atomic hysteria with which he grew up in 1993's Matinee. Very exciting.
Very exciting. Joe Dante's return to the show.
Yeah, one of the real lords of ADP, if you think about it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. One of his best films, Small Soldiers, was like a real early hype episode for us. We did The Burbs. I think that's it, right?
Because this is the third Joe Dante movie I've ever seen. So it's got to be our third episode on him.
No Gremlins. Wow.
No Gremlins. Never seen Gremlins in my life.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to, we'll fix that some other time. But until then, Kenzo, I have to know what you've been watching.
Oh, okay. Well, I was editing Monday's episode on Sunday, and I heard myself mention Julie Taymor's Titus, and lo and behold, after that recording and before I had edited, I did watch Julie Taymor's Titus, so I felt like I feel like I have to follow up on this. Full disclosure, got high in the middle of this movie. Weird movie to be high to, so that explains why my review was just all caps, either the worst movie of all time or the greatest. I can't decide. Audacious and insane. Thumbs up. I was so high at the end of that movie. It was crazy. But yeah, it's okay, so it's on YouTube. Well, for one, I'm not quite in the know of why it is very unavailable everywhere else. Like it's never streaming. It's not in print on physical media. I feel like there must be some sort of issue with the rights that I am not aware of. But thankfully some soul put it on YouTube. It's pretty decent quality, so you can go watch it there. Yeah, I was just sort of like, I don't know if I could call this a good movie, and I don't know if I could recommend this to someone wholeheartedly, because it is so like a, if you're into it, you're into it. If you're not, you're not. It is a confusing mess of a film. But like, Kev, you know us. We love films like Beau Is Afraid. We love films like Southland Tales. We love these audacious messes. And that is 100% what Titus is. Like, I say it all the time that to me, McKevzo is audacious filmmaking, and this is it at its finest, possibly.
Interesting. Okay.
It's just insane. It's Titus Andronicus, Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus. If you don't know what Titus Andronicus is about, crazy. I want to meet you. But it is known as kind of Shakespeare's bloodiest play. Lots of sexual assaults and murder and incest vibes, at least in this Taymor version. It is a excessive, opulent, disgusting play that many people find very hard to stage. And yeah, I don't know. Again, like, it's, watch 10 minutes of it. It's so weird. It's also weirdly connected to kind of nuclear atomic age anxiety. Yeah, I don't know what Taymor is doing here. But it's like, parts of it feel so brilliant and parts of it feel so absolutely crazy. I will say, as a tease, another reason why this is a deeply ADP film, incredible, incredible performance of Tamora, Queen of the Goths, from Jessica Lange. Fucking incredible Jessica Lange performance. It was her first time doing Shakespeare on film. It's like a mind-blowing performance. And the first aside is Tamora. And there's this moment where, because Anthony Hopkins plays Titus, she comes up close to the screen. We get like just the sliver of Hopkins because it's so tight on Tamora, who's right next to him. She says something to him, and then Jessica Lange just cuts her eyes into the camera and gives you, the audience, an aside. Rachel and I like cheered like we were at a football game. It was incredible. And the other highlight performance of the film comes from Mr. One Alan Cumming, who plays Saturninus, who's this, in this version, imagine, this is reductive, but like gay Hitler. He's like a very flamboyant fascist dictator who, when Titus refuses the role of emperor, Saturninus takes it on. He ends up marrying the aforementioned Jessica Lange to Mora, Queen of the Goths. So it's a kind of pseudo historical. So it's a little dense. So if you watch it and you don't know what's going on, it's normal. Alan Cumming is brilliant in this movie. He's playing this foppy fascist cuckoo bananas characterization. He has this like flippy bang. He's flipping the whole time. He's wearing these opulent like gender bending outfits and makeup. Him and Jessica Lange have, while he reads as queer, him and Jessica Lange have the most palpable fuck energy between them. Like the chemistry between the two of them is absolutely insane. And there's like a great story about Alan Cumming holding Jessica Lange's boobs on set that Rachel found. They became besties and their performances show it because they are incredible in this. So yeah, I recommend hesitantly. It's a weirdo. Like if you're not into it, you're not into it. Just turn it off. Like it's if you're not into it in the beginning, it's not going to get better. It's going to get so much worse.
Put that on a banner and hang it up outside the theater. If you're not liking this thing 10 minutes in, turn it off.
Like this movie will only get more cuckoo and crazy. So if you don't like it, like in the first chunk, it's not going to get better. So
I pulled it up on YouTube. All yeah. good.
Yeah.
Very excited. But then under music, it lists the soundtrack because YouTube videos, you know, they list the music.
Yeah,
just the cover of the soundtrack, which is Anthony Hopkins in the blue paint over and over and over and over again. It's very funny.
Wow.
Shepherd Fairey, the legacy of the repetitive image. Andy Warhol lives.
I love it. So yeah, hesitantly recommend. Rachel's review is just the epic highs and lows of Julie Taymor. And I agree. And also something else I found interesting. There's an account called Not Roger E that posts a lot of Roger Ebert reviews and I like to look at them. And critics hated this to say the least. And again, you watch 2 seconds of this movie and you see why critics hated it. Ebert loved it. Ebert was like the one critic that was like, this fucks actually. And again, that's why I love him.
Boom.
The only other thing I watched that I want to touch on briefly is, just because Kev, you have not seen it, Steve Martin, a documentary in 2 pieces on Apple TV Plus. As Amanda Dobbins said, we are 2 of the 3 along with her subscribers to Apple TV Plus.
Hey, I was watching Sugar on the Train. That's Colin Farrell. So good.
I'm watching Palm Royale. It's fine. Yeah, we're both. We'll get
an incredible review of that show. It's fine.
It's tonally confused, and we'll get into it. Let me
without getting too into a tangent, the vibe I'm getting from Palm Royale is they told the people who else was working on it, and they got hired without reading the script. Is the vibe I'm getting, because that's what Carol Burnett said on WTF, and I see no reason to believe that everyone else was not the same deal.
Everyone is in a different show. It's tonally confused. Doesn't know if it's a comedy or a drama, and it does not know how to sustain tension. Everything is like opened and resolved within episodes. And so it's being billed as like a mystery, but there's no tension at all. Whatever. I'm going to finish the season. I'm going to wait till the season ends and maybe I'll give a full recap of how I feel about Palms. I'm hoping it's showing glimmers of goodness in these latest episodes. So maybe it'll turn around. Anyway, Steve Martin, a documentary in 2 parts, is on Apple TV Plus now. If you even moderately like Steve Martin, if you've ever just had a positive thought about Steve Martin in your life, you owe it to yourself to watch this. From anyone from like, yeah, he's pretty cool, to mega super fan, I think you will find something to love in this documentary. The 2 parts are both 1.5 hours. It's a little bit of a commitment. They're both also very different in tone, so they feel pretty broken up to where you could split them up if you needed to. The first half almost completely focuses on his journey to stand-up king to the retirement of that, and it's so fascinating the way it takes 1.5 hours to like let you into his beginnings of like working at the magic shop at Disneyland and like falling in love with magic and kitsch and gimmick, speaking of matinee, and how that morphed over 15 years into the act that he became known for, and how like it didn't work for 15 years. It worked once, and then he became the biggest comedian to ever live. And
that's
like
insane.
And it's like, you don't even like, you know, we grew up, at least I grew up with Steve Martin, like movies only. And so it's like crazy to imagine that he was like selling out arenas. He was the first comedian to ever sell 1 million units of a record. Like, it's weird to think he was like the number one, like, thing, and then this transition to films kind of it took some time to really work for him. And so it gets into the highs and lows. It gets into his anxiety. It gets into his loneliness. It gets into his depression. It gets into his relationship with his dad that was very bad, and his relationship to eventually his the love of his life and his new daughter. He has a young daughter now, and like it's beautiful. It's really good. And then so part one is so like living in the past, and then part two is like documenting him now as he is. So it's a lot of him and Martin Short like hanging out, working on their show, reminiscing about the movies, but mostly just like Steve kind of reminiscing on like, wow, it took me like 60 years, but I finally kind of found happiness.
Amazing.
Like, fuck, it's amazing. Yeah, so like I'm rambling about it because it really genuinely touched me. I think it is absolutely perfect. Again, if you even moderately like Steve Martin, you owe it to yourself. And I learned things about him. I didn't know he was into classical art and art collecting. I didn't know he was into that. This is a major passion in his life, and it has been for 40 years, and they get into it. Yeah, it's exactly. You're like, Steve Martin is into like actively, he has like a Picasso. Like, he actively collects art. Like, it's crazy. You like learn new things about him, and you find new things to love in the movies you already loved, and like it's great. I truly can't recommend this more. Even if you get a trial of Apple TV Plus, watch it. It's so good.
And then watch The Morning Show.
And then watch The Morning Show and send us an email, austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. Kev, what did you watch this week?
I guess the biggest thing this week is that dear friend of the show, Scott, who is the host of a podcast, and the podcast is called This is the Greatest Song I've Ever Heard in My Entire Life, a podcast that Austin Danger Podcast has appeared on and may appear on again. We went to see The People's Joker at the IFC Center. Fancy premiere of The People's Joker. The director, Vera Drew, was there, and the playwright, Jeremy O'Harris, did like a very rushed, weird... When you were in it, it wasn't rushed, but you could tell plans were changing on the spot. Interview, magazine interview that might even be available now. I have no idea, but it was a lot of fun. The movie, if folks haven't heard by now, The People's Joker is most famous because despite being a parody that falls under fair use, it was shut down at the Toronto International Film Festival last year. Basically, what happened was they made a deal with Warner saying like, hey, for people who don't know, this is Vera Drew, who is an editor who has like worked on you name it over the last 10 years. Nathan For You, Tim and Eric, On Cinema. Like, she's done it all.
I wonder if she was a part of that crew.
Oh, yeah. And you could tell the lineage. So this is
absolutely.
So this
it
is
makes
first
more
feature.
Sense now. Yeah.
And it is a DIY, real like a patchwork parody of Batman that is also a coming of age story that is also a trans coming of age story about but that's basically biographical. There were points in the movie where Vera Drew, who was sitting like next to me over the aisle, had to like leave and stuff, and she even pointed that out, which is why I'm mentioning it, like, because things were intense. But they all move so fast. It's an incredible film. So anyway, that they made a deal with Warner saying, like, we all know this is a parody, but you cannot issue a cease and desist. Like, we're going to do one screening and that's it. And somewhere over the last 6 months, they found a way. So now, hopefully, you can see The People's Joker at your local art house. And hopefully, Altered Innocence, who is the people putting it out, can get it on VOD and stuff. This is maybe the worst sales pitch for the movie I could make, but the movie itself is likewise this, I don't want to say unfocused, because that's not what I mean, and it sounds more negative than I'm getting at, but it is, it is just about a movie. Do you know what I mean? I'll review it this way. In between high school and college, my friends and I did a movie. I didn't write it. My friends Josh and Dan wrote it. It's called The Good Old Days. And it is also just barely a movie. And it is not about any of these very important, very relevant themes. And it is not a personal thing at all. But watching The People's Joker reminded me of The Good Old Days, because it was so obvious, A, where Vera's influences are. Like, the experience of working with Absolutely on all those comedy shows, like, makes total sense. You can see, like, there are some sequences that are like, oh, that's like On Cinema. Amazing. Like, this is this, you learned to do this while editing this On Cinema thing. maybe you didn't even do it, but like it feels like it enough. Like you could see the lineage feed in.
Yeah.
I'm scrambling because it's an impossible movie to describe, but if you listen to this show, you're going to want to watch it. That's really all I can say. I don't think it's going to win Best Picture at the Austins or anything, but if there was some kind of award for like capturing the spirit of Austin Powers, you can't do much better, in my opinion, than this film.
I was wondering why like Tim Heidecker was in the cast, and now it all makes sense. That's so, like based on the trailer, now I totally see where that style is coming from. Absolutely.
And she worked on Comedy Bang Bang as well. And Scott Aukerman, the host of that show, is in the movie too.
Incredible.
Blink and you'll miss it. I couldn't spot him. But all this to say, highly recommended. You better see it. It's great. See it while you still can, if you can. It'll be at the Music Box, no doubt, beyond the sold out thing. So that's People's Joker. Again, this was a rambling mess from my side of the microphone, but the movie is kind of that way too, but in the best possible way. You should see it. Highly recommended. Then you could tell people you saw the People's Joker. How cool is that? What else did I see? I went to Immaculate. Scott and I were talking during People's Joker. Not during the movie, people, please. But we were talking. And he convinced me to check out Immaculate, which is the Sydney Sweeney nun movie.
Mm.
And that was pretty good. I was surprised. But it's one of those movies, I'm wondering if we could broach this a little bit. It made me mad that I had to give it a rating on Letterboxd. You know what I mean? Like, I'm usually dogged on for my high ratings for things anyway.
Mm-hmm.
As if I couldn't enjoy Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I'll never understand, but okay. Okay. But like, all this to say, like, it made me mad that I had to rate it because I was like, this is a 3.5-star movie. It's a perfect 3.5-star movie. But like, it's a perfect 3.5-star movie. I had a great time. It was a lot of fun. It was good. It moved quickly. It's like 89 minutes. Perfect. Sydney Sweeney didn't quite get it early, but then she does, there's a switch and it's like, oh yeah, right. I was impressed to learn that she came to the director with the script.
Yeah.
Like, this is my project and we're going to make this. Do you want to be the guy who makes it? Which is like a really cool thing that I didn't think people could do.
Well, I saw that like she read it like 6 years ago or something, and then like it got shelved, but she loved the script so much she like wanted to get it out of kind of development hell and like actually get it on its feet, which I think is really cool.
Sure. And it also changed in a bunch of ways, like before they shot and during the shoot, it had to change on the spot. So So that was pretty good. I'm just reflecting on Letterboxd scores. Do I need to give scores? I mean, I don't need to. Who cares? But like,
it sucks when a movie puts you in this existential place, because I feel that way too. Like, I felt that way with Titus. I was like, this movie cannot be rated to me. Like, it's and then you doubt and you're like, why do I rate movies at all? Why do my opinions matter? Like, I fall into an existential spiral sometimes after a movie like that.
What if I'm preventing myself from watching all sorts of really great movies that are beyond my horizons because I'm like, I'm not going to like this movie. I'm going to rate this movie 2 stars a letterbox. Like, I'm not going to click play on that. Like, what else am I missing? Because I had a really awesome time. And the movie I won't name that I saw after that, I had a much less good time at.
Yeah.
So I was like, why am I even rating movies at all? So I don't know. Maybe you might see some changes from Kev. On Letterboxd. I don't know. But that's it. Really, I don't... Like, do people want to hear a Monkey Man talk? We didn't love Monkey Man. I'll tell you straight up.
We both did not like Monkey Man.
We did not love Monkey Man. You probably read everything I have to say about it in my Letterboxd review.
Same. It's just too much of a mess. It looked bad.
Look.
It was shallow.
It is obvious watching it that it had gone through some
hell.
Pretty tough
yeah.
editing hell. Like, post-production hell. I get it. But unfortunately, I'm not writing for the Chicago Sun-Times. I'm writing for Kev's Letterboxd, and Kev didn't have a great time with the movie. So, but next feature is going to be great, because
yes.
you're going to get all the control you want, because the movie's going to do really well.
It's already
and
made back
on
what
Letterboxd,
Universal paid for it. So,
well, there you have it right there. And people love Dev, so they'll go rate it whatever.
Yeah, I love Dev too.
So don't listen to us.
We're huge Dev lovers in this house.
ADP is a house that loves Dev Patel.
The house that Dev Patel built.
It's clear and unfortunate that there were a lot of production problems that made this movie like there's stuff going on in this movie that I didn't know about until Mackenzie told me in a DM later.
Yeah.
There's entire facets of this movie that are unclear to me. And maybe that's my fault. If I don't know the thing, it's not my fault.
Well, speaking of Kevin McKenzie's DMs.
Whoop-dit news. What does it all mean, Basil?
Now it's time for Austin News. This is the weekly segment where we bring you all of the shagadelic smashing news, baby, in the world of Austin Powers. And usually that's wind up for me to say that we have no Austin news. But this week we actually have a piece of massive Austin news. Kenzo, please bring it to the nice people.
What the world needs now. Ladies and gentlemen, introducing Mr. Burt Bacharach.
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing the Joker.
Yes. Burt Bacharach's What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love, that is featured in the first Austin Powers, was heavily featured in the new fucking awesome, I'm sorry, Joker Folie à Deux trailer.
If you're not on the train for Joker Folie à Deux, I respect your opinion. We're doing it on this show, so just skip ahead to the matinee talk, I suppose, for the next 5 minutes.
I've never seen the first one, you know, I'm saving it for the show. That'll be my first watch on Austin Danger Podcast.
Yeah.
But like, I always knew I was probably going to watch this because I've been a massive Lady Gaga fan for, I mean, over 10 years now at this point. I adore her. I see every movie she's in. I watched fucking House of Gucci for her. So I knew I'd be wanting to see this, but nothing could have prepared me for what my eyes saw today.
So the first Joker, the influence was Martin Scorsese, Taxi Driver, King of Comedy. It looks like now Todd Phillips is struggling, the director, is struggling with committing to calling this a musical. But he said that his key inspiration was Francis Ford Coppola's One from the Heart, which is like a pretty deranged movie. So I have a lot of hope for this. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be great to do on the show because there's been a lot of discussion around the Joker movie. And I think once you see it, you'll realize that it is deeply, it tackles some things very seriously, but it is what Logan Roy would call a deeply unserious film. But yes, no. So what a crazy thing though. Like I thought, oh, wouldn't it be funny? And maybe a Grip Links, but no, Burt Bacharach will bring it all together as we ascend the giant staircase in the Bronx to Joker Folie à Deux. Wording of that title subject to change, but we're on the stairs, baby. We're climbing.
We're getting to that movie. Yeah, I mean, I love the Golden Age musical sets that we're seeing. Gaga looks unhinged. I mean, this is our La La Land, Kev. Maybe our La La Land has arrived.
Yeah, if they use songs that exist, that gives them the edge over La La Land, in my opinion.
I have,
not to be rude,
an inkling that why, this is my prediction. I have McKinsey's prediction corner. I have an inkling that the reason why Todd Phillips is so like being kind of weird about calling it as a musical is that it will heavily feature music, but I think they're just going to be lip syncing to like standards. And I wonder if everyone just assumes like it's, they'll be singing because he cast Gaga, but maybe there's a subversion there a little bit that like she won't actually be singing, even though we think she will. I don't know. That's a prediction I have.
I predict that Gaga will write a song and it will be at least pretty good.
Yeah, probably.
But please make no mistake, that is the only piece of Austin news. Jay Roach currently prepping his War of the Roses remake. He is probably getting out some whiteboards of his own.
The road to War of the Roses.
Which I'm realizing I just called out whiteboards. That's a reference to a discussion we had over an hour and a half ago before we even started recording. So I'm having quite a night.
We're having a night.
The road to the War of the Roses. But Kenzo, I feel like we've stalled long enough and it's finally time to return to the childhood of one of our great artists, Mr. Joe Dante, with Matinee.
J Gene Loomis is a young army brat in Key West, 1962, who loves going to the local movie theater with his little brother Dennis. When they find out that producer Lawrence Woolsey's new horror film, Mant, is arriving the following weekend, they get excited to go and see all the gimmicks that Woolsey has planned for the film. When they return home just before dinner, their mother tells them that their dad was shipped off on something secretive, but connects the dots when President Kennedy delivers a national speech confirming the presence of Soviet missiles in Cuba, less than 100 miles away. Though Woolsey's girlfriend and muse, actress Ruth Corday, thinks they should hold on the premiere due to recent news, Woolsey sees it as the perfect way to sell the film even further, leaning into the nuclear themes of the movie. Meanwhile, Gene is drawn to a girl at school named Sandra who has more liberal, open-minded sensibilities and protests the usefulness of the school's duck and cover policies, while Gene's new buddy Stan navigates a budding relationship with another girl named Sherry. Unfortunately for Stan, though, Sherry's ex-boyfriend, who seems to be some college-age wannabe, scares Stan into staying away from Sherry, whom he initially agreed to go on a date with on Saturday. Stan cancels on Sherry with a lie and decides to go see Mant with Gene and his little brother. Saturday arrives and Mant is here. Woolsey has numerous gimmicks planned, including having the kids sign waivers in case they die from fear, shocking their seats, and a new subwoofer gimmick called Rumble-rama to create an unforgettable experience at the movies. The anxious cinema manager isn't quite sold on the gimmicks as he's terrified of the looming missile threat, but Woolsey tells him not to worry. The film begins and so does the drama. Sherry ends up at the screening with her little brother and catches Stan in his lie, but thankfully Gene comes to his rescue and the two reconcile. Unfortunately for Stan, Harvey, the wannabe ex, has been hired to play the real-life Ant-Man in another gimmick, and when he spots the two of them together, he goes crazy and the kids must run away from him. So they run to the basement of the cinema to find a fallout shelter that the anxious manager had planned to use and is able to scare off Harvey with a shotgun found in the shelter. Okay, look, a lot of rigmarole happens here, but what it boils down to is Gene and his crush get trapped inside the fallout shelter, thinking that the missiles have launched when it was really just the Rumble-rama upstairs. Woolsey helps rescue the kids, who are having their first kiss as they run out of oxygen, and they rush back upstairs to find Harvey holding Ruth hostage, demanding the premiere's revenue. Harvey then kidnaps Sherry and steals the cash, but is quickly arrested as law enforcement were there due to the chaos happening at the Mant screening. Woolsey realizes that the Rumble-rama technology was turned up too high and the balcony is completely falling apart. Assisted by Gene, Woolsey projects horrifying realistic atomic bomb footage in order to scare the audience into evacuating. Gene realizes his little brother is trapped on the balcony but is able to rescue him and finally escape, but not before revealing to his mother that even the theater fire is all an illusion, just a gimmick. After the chaos of the day, the Cuban Missile Crisis ends, and Woolsey and Ruth, yeah, I know. I laughed when I wrote it, too. And Woolsey and Ruth head to another premiere. Gene and his new girlfriend, Sandra, watch the Navy helicopters fly over the bay, returning his dad to Key West. Wow. What a matinee.
Boom. Nailed it.
That last chunk has so many moving pieces I did not know how to describe.
Yeah, it gets dense quick, huh?
Yeah, it does. But it's a tight 90, baby.
That's right. So let's talk about it. Kenzo, you hadn't seen this.
Never seen this. The only other Joe Dante films I've seen, I watched on the show. So Small Soldiers and The Burbs. But the vibes are off the charts with Joe Dante. And I was aware of this movie because I think I've seen you log it before, right? You believe you did it on Ammonite, which I'm sure you'll talk about momentarily. Right. And like, I've seen you and other friends log it, so I've been aware of the poster, John Goodman smiling back, and I didn't realize Kathy Moriarty's in it, who I love and have a lot of like loved her in Casper when I was a kid, and me and my friends would always impersonate her in high school. She's great. But I'm a cheerleader, love Kathy Moriarty. Rachel was happy to see Omri Katz from Hocus Pocus here. So like the cast I have some history with, and you know, and Joe, it's been chronicled on the show, but Kev, this is an all-timer for you, correct?
It's pretty new, but when you know, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I watched this. I forget what led me to the movie, but yes, I picked it for Ammonite, and as soon as I saw it, I just completely fell for it. In the way that I have for like every other Joe Dante film I've seen, except maybe The Howling. And even then, I think I just wasn't in the mood for The Howling. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So when he does his Cinema Paradiso here, how am I not to fall in love? You know what I mean? How could I resist? with John Goodman as the William Castle type. Dude, that felt so personal to me. Like, if I could have a GIF of the shot of John Goodman turning off the projector, we're cooking. Like, that would be, folks, austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. Please upload it to Tenor so I can use it on Discord. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, I love this movie. And I guess we should just get into it, Kenzo.
John Goodman is so fucking good in this movie. It is disgusting. He's incredible.
This is like, this is kind of the peak of his powers as a comedy lead. He's on Roseanne. He's in the Flintstones, I think, the next year. Mm-hmm. So, like, as this is coming out, he's, like, filming or prepping to film the Flintstones. King Ralph is just around the corner, I
Lebowski
think.
Lebowski at the end of the decade.
Yes, Lebowski in a couple years. Like, he had already established his working relationship with the Coens that would carry him through 2-3 phases of his career. And you could immediately see, even though he's putting on a very affected performance, like everyone kind of is in this movie, mm-hmm. you can tell there was some clear direction on that. You can see his genuine charm come through in this kind of grifter character.
He is,
and the warmth he exudes in all of his like comedic leaning to kids movie roles, but particularly here, helps to sew together the kind of the ooey gooey sentimental heart of the movie.
That is so perfectly put. As soon as he showed up, Rachel looked over and said, "Oh, he's so handsome." And we both were just saying how we were like, he's so charming and handsome. And the way he, like, I don't know. Like, I guess sometimes his characters to me, he plays like, again, like when I think of him, I do think of Lebowski. So I think of that character as like a heavy, angry, aggressive character. And I feel like I see him play these kind of larger than life, like these villains. I even think of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, that kind of villain role right. he plays there. This character is so light and airy and breezy, and the way he kind of walks with so much swagger and confidence, and like the way he carries himself in these situations where he like things are falling apart and like the children are trapped in the fallout shelter, and he kind of just swaggers over and lightly touches it, you know, messes with it for a second, taps, like immediately knows what to do. It's like this guy never breaks a sweat, and I just think he's so cool and like effortless. And then he also feels so kind. Like you see him with this affection for the kids, and like we'll get into it in a bit, but I watched a William Castle documentary because I actually didn't really know much about him at all. And watching that documentary and seeing how much he loved the younger audiences and how much he engaged with these younger audiences where they were at, it makes this characterization make all the more sense that he's so like kind to kids. And yeah, you feel like if I was a kid watching this, I'd feel like, oh wow, there are cool adults who will just like listen to me and treat me like a grown up. Like, isn't that cool? Like, it's, yeah, he holds the movie together for me. He's perfect.
You see, the people come into your cave with a 200-year-old carpet. The guy tears your ticket in half. It's too late to turn back now. Water fountain's all booby trapped and ready. The stuff laid out on the candy counter. Then you come over here to where it's dark. It could be anything in there. And you say,
here I am. What have you got for me?
Exactly right. And he's the bridge also between the nostalgia aspect of thinking back to the childhood and then the movie, the 50s movie aspect, which is an aspect of the childhood, but you know what I mean? Like, the movie's about two things. It's about growing up during the Cold War, and it's about William Castle B movies, and that intersects.
Yes.
While we're talking about performances here, I'm wondering, I'm laughing. My one of my big points is just John Goodman, the God.
The God, yes.
It's true. I'm wondering what you think of the lead kid, of the Gene performance.
It took a second to grow on me, but I really ended up liking him a lot by the end. I wasn't quite sure about him at the beginning, especially because I knew Omri Katz was going to be in it. And like, I have that association with him in Hocus Pocus where he's great. And so I was like, who's this blonde kid for the first little chunk? But then like, yeah, he kind of grew on me. And the moment he grew on me, Rachel wasn't super watching. She was kind of just coming in and out while she was writing today. But the moment that got both of us, that I think made me be like, okay, I'm on this kid's side. Like, I'm in with this performance, is when his little brother is in bed asking him about dad, and he's really nervous, and he says, I'm scared. And then Gene says, everybody's scared. And I don't know why. It was the way he said that to his brother in such a mature and loving way, like coming through for his little brother in that moment. It was so honest and it genuinely really touched me. And I was like, okay, I'm in on this kid. Like, this is great. This is a great performance.
Yeah, I agree. You definitely warm up to him throughout. And I also just learned that he's English.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge for a child actor. And that totally paints the whole movie in a different color for me. It's like, yes. Oh, well, in that case, why didn't you just say so? It's great. But there were points in the first act where I was like, this may be getting a little too like kitty, ooey gooey, sentimental, etc. Not out of our wheelhouse or anything, but I was concerned about how that would go.
Oh, like the tone, this like saccharine tone?
Yeah, but
tone.
He's also playing awkward. Yeah, so that is part of it, but his performance is also like very, he's trying to play awkward, I think.
Yes.
Is the thing, and it just comes off kind of weird.
Yes. I feel that.
But I'm glad you vibe with the gooiness.
I did. I mean, I went back and forth on it a lot throughout the movie because it's so saccharine. Like it's so, so sweet a lot. And like occasionally there's moments where to me, like the moment that like leaps out to me is when like him and Sandra are having that first interaction and the soundtrack is really romantic Lifetime movie-y. It's like, I don't think I need this type of music to score this particular moment. And like, because of that, there's moments where it verges on cloying, but I don't think it ever fully goes there. Like it toes the line between like saccharine and cloying, and I think it toes it well. It ended up working for me, but it got close to a couple times for not working for me.
Yeah, I'm wondering, okay, this is a great point. You touched a nerve here.
Oh.
First of all, we all know Jerry Goldsmith is going into the Austin Danger Podcast Hall of Fame.
Boom.
Just a matter of when. I say this as a fan of the man, and I've praised him regularly on this show. He is a goat. Kenzo is visibly looking up his IMDb right now.
Yes.
But like when you see it, you're going to see what I mean. The guy's a legend. And I'm winding it up like this all to say that this is a very rare Jerry Goldsmith L.
Whoa.
And I'm wondering, I just, some of this score, and I think it's he leaned too much into the synth for the sentimental, and it comes off feeling like an episode of Family Ties and not one of the fun episodes of Family Ties. You know what I mean? Sometimes. Mostly it's pretty good. Like this guy, his worst work is pretty damn good. But I just don't think the use of synth here worked for me.
Wow.
Why are you gasping?
My jaw's just been dropped. I just couldn't believe. You have this at 5 stars. I just couldn't believe.
Yeah. It's a great movie. This is one of my favorite movies. It's incredible. I love it. But I also have some things with it. Like, look, when Damien Chazelle went back to work on Babylon, they used the motifs from La La Land that I hated. You know, movies I love do things all the time that I don't love. It's okay. It's a part of life. This is the rating thing. Like, you know. It's great. But I do think the synth in some spaces, like when it gets sentimental and then the synth comes in to like replace a string.
Yeah.
No likey. And this is like the pieces are, well, in my opinion, the pieces are like pretty good.
There's times where it works and times where it doesn't. Absolutely. And that's where it's like you get worried. That's why I was wavering a lot, I think, on the movie. It was because it's a strange experience. And that score is the big part of that.
Okay, to be clear, the synth is the L.
Mm.
I think the music itself is as effective as any Goldsmith score. But the synth is a big... It got stuck in my craw.
I could tell. Kathy Moriarty, one of our greatest character actresses.
Yeah, no doubt future legend. I forgot that she made her debut in Raging Bull.
Yeah, she's fucking amazing in that.
She's incredible in Raging Bull. She will be a, oh my God, Kindergarten Cop, Soap Dish, Casper, But I'm a Cheerleader. Analyze that, which is going to be one of our great episodes. Just wait. Oh, she's in the Richard Ayoade, Jesse Eisenberg, Kafka, it's a Dostoevsky adaptation called The Double. My God.
In Casper, she plays a character named Kerrigan Crittenden, the villain in that movie. And for some reason, my friend Grayson and I don't even I do I doubt Grayson will ever listen to this podcast. My high school friend Grayson and I used to do a bit where we called ourselves Karen Kerrigan, and we just did our best Kathy Moriarty. So we would call each other and leave each other voicemails and go, "Hi, it's Karen Kerrigan. I just calling to let you know that I am." And we would just do our best. We would just leave each other voicemails as Kathy Moriarty, and I don't know where that came from in high school. In high school, Kev.
That's like Shillelagh Cinnamon.
What the fuck is
which,
that?
The origin of Shillelagh Cinnamon, I will not reveal on Austin Pod. You can go back and listen to a past episode of the show, not telling which one, to find out the origin of that.
Naomi Watts, film debut?
Yes. Oh my God. This is, okay. Listen.
I activated you just now.
Aside, this is the sixth star moment for me. So, if you haven't seen the movie, go fucking watch the movie. Excuse me. Pay the $5. This is a great movie, and I'm telling you right now, if you like Gremlins, you're going to love this because you get it. If you love Gremlins 2, this is probably already one of your favorite movies as well.
My cheeks hurt from smiling, Kev.
So, obviously, John Goodman is William Castle, and we live in a world where everybody watches movies. So, to support that, you have to create other movies. And so they've created this incredibly brilliant parody of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Bedknobs and Broomsticks and Mary Poppins and all these fucking 9-hour long kids musicals about magical British ladies. It's called The Shook Up Shopping Cart, and the star returning from King Kong, Naomi Watts.
I thought it was like a parody of like Herbie Fully Loaded, like an inanimate object comes to life.
Yes, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Yeah, same principle. And sorry, Mary Poppins was the stretch of that, but it's the same tone. Mm. It's like, oh, there's a magical thing and it comes to life and we love it. Like, you know.
Naomi Watts,
magical shopping cart,
is amazing in her 5 seconds. She's incredible.
I had totally forgotten about this. And when I saw it, I lost my mind. I was like, this is the greatest shit ever. This is the most expensive inside joke for just me I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen Christopher Walken's performance in Dune Part 2.
Oh my God.
I fucking loved it. And then obviously Naomi Watts is great. And we'll talk about her more in the Mulholland Drive.
I'll say Mulholland Drive. Podcast.
Mr. Adams, we have to find Uncle Cedric before he gets in any more trouble.
Well, what does Uncle Cedric look like?
Well, he's a shopping cart, you know, chromium finish, and his right front wheel, it's sort of wobbly.
A shopping cart?
Yes. Well, of course he wasn't always a shopping cart. You see, he had a spell put on him, and it's all my fault, really, because...
All right, stick him up, both of you. Give me his voice.
You see? He likes you.
Kenzo, I'll be real. What is a movie, if not a dark place for you to eat popcorn in?
Yes.
In which you eat popcorn.
Okay.
So with that in mind, I think we should pop some corn.
Why did I think? I thought you had already started
did you
the
think
popcorn.
I was just talking about nothing.
I thought this was one of your popcorn notes. So I was sitting there being like, when is popcorn in the movie this heavily? I was so fucking confused.
We're on a roll.
Christ alive.
Mackenzie, popcorn, please.
The moment that made me laugh so hard at the very beginning was in the advert when he goes, we've been something like featured in national magazines. And he doesn't like show you the national magazines. He just passes them quickly through the camera, obviously meaning like they're not in national magazines. And it just made me laugh really hard. I loved that so much. I had to rewind it and show it to Rachel. So this is based on Dante's childhood. You kind of said that a lot at the beginning, and I was getting that inkling pretty immediately. Is this like confirmed he based this off of his childhood?
I don't think it's like one-to-one or anything, but let me... I don't know for sure. I really don't.
Well,
I'm just saying like the age and the vibe line up is all I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree. I was getting that vibe like the whole time. So I was also there. I was literally like saying to Rachel, I was like, why did they do Duck and Cover? Like, what would that have actually solved? Like, it's not, me and Rachel were sitting here debating Duck and Cover. I was like, it's not, what's putting your hand, laying down and putting your hands. And I was saying that to Rachel. And then this little girl walks out saying it. And they go, that girl's a communist. It just made me laugh that I was like saying the exact same things moments before she did.
Yeah, it's one thing to see like a parody of it in like The Iron Giant, for example, which does do a pretty good Duck and Cover. It's not a parody, but it's like representation of what they told kids. Mm. But man, seeing it in person, especially in a time where like that nuclear war book came out and I heard the first chapter, which is like, what if, right? Mm. It's like telling you what would happen. Jesus. Like, this is a different, I have to say, this is a different movie after reading that nuclear war book. Jesus. Mm. Anyway, go ahead.
The next thing I wrote was like, so this is such a long-winded like explanation for this, but so I recently acquired a hard to find Blu-ray of Sense and Sensibility, Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility. And we watched it, and the fucking film grain on this baby is the most gorgeous thing I've ever seen in my goddamn life. It is so beautiful. My TV was a little too sharp at first. I softened it. It was like, perfect. Chef kiss. It was the best thing I've ever seen in my life. And it's like, that film, it gives it like an age and a texture that like brings the world to life. And it makes you feel like you are really in that period. Like I felt,
oh yeah,
I felt so immersed in the movie. It was so amazing. And I felt that way about this too. Like it, everything felt so real and lived in, and you felt like this was a time and place, and it really transported me there genuinely. And like the house felt so lived in and poor and kitschy, and like these characters felt so real. And I just was like, wow, that is, I think, part of the they don't make them like this anymore package. And I'm like, it has to do with not shooting on film anymore, because I mentioned the lackluster Palm Royale set 1969, just, you know, 7-ish years after this film is set. And like Palm Royale never doesn't look like it's in 2024. You know what I mean? It's this glossy Apple TV Plus digital cinematography. And it's very like colorful, but muted colorful and very soft and glossy, and like it doesn't actually transport me to this beautiful place. Like I can see the budget, I see these beautiful costumes and sets, but like it's so modern in a way that like I think of, I see this movie or something like Sense and Sensibility, where like I do think that aspect of texture and age on the film itself that I'm seeing, it transports me a little bit more. And I think that's why period pieces from kind of more pre-digital era I think work for me better. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I
had that written down and I was like, this is going to be a ramble and I don't know how, if I'm going to make any sense.
Oh, no, I get you. I mean, I'll say, look, I watched the Shout Factory Blu-ray of this film, which is like phenomenal looking. I don't know how it could look any better, even though Joe Dante supervised a scan for the new 4K. But like, even so, I was like, how are they going to top this?
My finger's on the trigger for that 4K.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first sale, I'm picking it up. I mean, look, this is, I mean, it's matinee. I got to pick it up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't remember what prompted this, but I said Goodman is my favorite guy to watch in movies. I just love him.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Okay. I teared up in this movie.
Yeah.
His monologue about monster movies and why people love horror movies, into that magic of going into a movie theater part of that monologue. I totally teared up. That was a little like movie lover in me. I was so moved by that moment, genuinely.
It's beautiful. And it's everything. It's like, this is why it feels like Dante's Cinema Paradiso.
Yes, I agree.
It feels like his treatise is to like, this is why I love this. This is what I love. This is how I love it. And this is why.
It's perfect. And I got all of that there, and it made me emotional. And it's funny what he said about horror films, like kind of made horror films make more sense to me. This idea of they are a reminder that you're alive. And yeah, I don't know. It's great. Like the line, takes a lot to scare people these days. Too much competition. Incredibly relevant, unfortunately. Yep. The giant ant arms over the theater marquee. Fucking amazing.
So good.
The clips from Mant are incredible. You mentioned that on the features of the Blu-ray and presumably the 4K as well, there's a just full version of Mant. I will be watching that.
Yeah, they shot like a full Mant. It's not like a full movie, but the scenes that they show in the movie, they shot full scenes for editing purposes. So it's really funny.
Someone
highly recommended.
Needs to put it on Letterboxd so we can log it as a movie.
There you go, Slim. Any minute now, buddy.
This is around the time where I was like, it's pretty saccharine, but never feels cloying. And then I wrote, this is just freaking fun. I was just having a good time with it. The whole destruction of the theater section is amazing. And the reveal of the screen, like, I was so tricked by that, that the reveal of the screen is fake because it looks so realistic. Like, the screen was burning down. I was genuinely amazed. It like made me, it made me feel like a kid again, because I was so genuinely shocked and surprised by it. Like, I got tricked and it felt like I was at a magic show, genuinely. And I'm watching a movie. And then my last note was, I loved the ending with Goodman and Moriarty. I think they're such a cute couple, and I think that they're really great. And their energies play off each other so well. And like their little, like, we might have kids, into the little kiss and cuddle at the end. Love it. I would take a whole series that was just the two of them going to from city to city. Like, I would have taken, they would have been amazing.
Palm Royale 2.
Yes. Not to fold this into my popcorn, but I did check out Spine Tingler. The story of William Castle. So it's so funny. When the thing started and he was doing the profile thing, I thought Alfred Hitchcock, but because I did not really know who William Castle was. And so I looked up this documentary and I remembered then that I recently watched one of John Waters' specials, and he talks about the Tingler and William Castle's inspiration on him. And that makes total sense for like all of John Waters' shit that he was inspired by William Castle. But he's in this documentary as well as a talking head, and he's great. And while the documentary, I think, is a little surface level, it doesn't really get into his legacy in a way that feels satisfying. If you just want to, like, it was really great for me who knew nothing about him, because it kind of just gave me an introduction into all of like how he came to be, how he was kind of working with Orson Welles as a young man before transitioning into this type of film. And it gives you like an idea of all the different gimmicks, and you can see so much of where all the stuff from Matinee comes from. So to me, it was a great double feature to pair this like short documentary with Matinee, because I feel like I learned so much about him, and I would love to see the Tingler in theater with the zapping seats. I think that would be awesome.
At Music Box, at Film Form.
Literally. And then, yeah, he like battled kind of, he was like in competition with Hitchcock. So learning about that was so interesting. And like his whole saga with Rosemary's Baby, he was a producer on that. And like, it was a whole saga. Yeah. It's a whole part of his career. And then the downfall of his career, unfortunately, and his death. And like, yeah, it's great. And then they talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and John Waters talks about how like after Kennedy's death, the cynicism that rooted itself into our country made tastes change. So by the time he's trying to make a late career comeback, people don't want the Tingler. They want Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And John right. Waters is talking to that a little bit. And it's great. It's a really fun, like, it's pretty surface level. It's probably a 3-star doc, but like, absolutely, if you're someone like me and you didn't know a lot about William Castle, I can't recommend it enough after or before you watch Matinee.
Well, there you go. There you have it.
Kev, give me your corn.
Let's pop some corn. The sun is getting low. Sometimes you'll see a movie and the logo inside the movie for the movie is different than the one on the poster. I think we could have maybe taken some lessons from the poster on this one. Mm. This font was like weird word art. Like, what even was that? I was stunned by that. A lot about John Goodman being charming, great silhouette. I loved... Again, a moment where Joe Dante was talking to me personally was like Goodman seeing an alligator and then pitching like a man becomes alligator. I love when he gets mistaken for Alfred Hitchcock. Again, tipping to the William Castle, Alfred mm-hmm. Hitchcock rivalry. Shout out to Dick Miller as one of the protesters, the plant
yes!
protesters. Just a fucking legend of cinema.
One of my most watched actors. I'm not kidding.
No kidding. Wow.
Like, I've seen so many of his movies. It's goofy.
Well, that's probably, is that, what is that, the Bogue Journey?
I mean, he's in all of the Joe Dante movies. I have seen Looney Tunes back in action. So it was like Looney Tunes, Small Soldiers, Burbs. He's in Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. He's in Terminator. He's in Mask of the Phantasm. He's in After Hours. And he's in New York, New York.
Well, shoot, I didn't even know.
Oh, and he's in Rock and Roll High School, which I guess I've seen.
I guess. Wow, what a ringing endorsement of Rock and Roll High School. I also don't really love Rock and Roll High School, but I guess I've seen it too.
Wow, this man's filmography is great.
I love how the crowd behaves in such a way that like a 50s crowd would absolutely have behaved, or early 60s crowd, I suppose, would absolutely have behaved this way, where like they're fighting back against the protesters in favor of like rational thought and free speech. I don't know if that was an intentional gag, but fucking hilarious gag of like, oh, like a rational mob. It was really silly and really funny.
Yes.
To me. There's no amendment to the Ten Commandments was a great scene ending bit of dialogue. The shout outs to Fangoria are great. Grew into Gene. We talked about it. Also, not for nothing, but some of the campy Cold War stuff felt a little scary this time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. There's just stuff going on lately in this old world where instead of embracing how funny this all is, you're doing that, of course. But then there's like a sliver of me that's like,
I completely agree. Completely agree.
We're walking right back into that in a lot of ways. So I'm very scared. The last thing I want to talk about is what we've already talked about a couple times, is that I love the flow of the film. I love that we're just hanging out for like the first hour, really getting to know Gene and his world and the base and the Bay of Pigs happening and all the stakes. And then we get to just go to the movies and enjoy Mant on its own as its own chunk of the structure of the film. I really loved that. And it really endears you, I think, to all the characters. Big fan of that. Jack, Sandra's father looks like Jordan B. Peterson. And I'll end on, really amazing gag from Mant. Behold the great emancipator, because he cracked open the ant farm. Yes. Hysterical.
Yes.
And yeah, I'll just repeat that the shot of John Goodman shutting the projector down is one of my favorites of all time. So good. And that's my popcorn, which brings us to final thoughts and star rating. So, Mackenzie?
There were times as I was watching that I wasn't sure if it was working for me. Again, it was like to do with like the score at times and like the tone. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, is it going a bit too cloying?
Yeah,
is it going to get away from me? And like by the end, I just had such a huge smile on my face. I was moved. It made me happy. It made me love movies. It made me learn about a filmmaker, William Castle, who I would not have known about otherwise. And it just delighted me to no end. And I think for what it is and what it's trying to do, it does it absolutely perfectly. So I'm not going to be picky and I'm going to give this 5 stars.
No, come on.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
No, I want to. I couldn't tell. And I said, are my issues big enough for me to drop it to 4? And I sat there, because that's why I went to whole stars, because I like feeling like I have to be a bit more, I don't know, like I have to feel a bit strongly about it now. And I think through a little bit now that I don't use half stars. And I was like, are my nitpicks enough to bring it to 4? And I said, no. So I want to keep it at 5, because I think that like on a rewatch, the issues I have with it will probably be nothing. And because now I know the expectations going in, I know the tone going in. So on a rewatch, it's probably going to be 5 stars. So why not just start it there? Since I know on a rewatch, it'll get there anyway. So.
Well, as long as you're not doing it on my account. I mean,
no, I freaking love this movie. Right, I really genuinely love this movie. And good. I want to buy this 4K so I can watch it again. Like really soon. Like I really genuinely love it.
That 4K is going to look great. Look, the Blu-ray, I have to tell you, it looks nuts.
I need that 4K. I might literally buy it in 2 days when I get paid.
Dick Miller's forehead is going to look like the Grand Canyon in 4K.
I'm really excited. I'm going to buy it, literally.
And for me, right down the middle, 5 stars. Not a secret. Not a surprise. And what more can I say? I really love it. I'm a little tired right now, to tell you the truth. So I don't know if my energy is coming across, but I really love this film. I think it's a lot of fun. And it taps into a lot of the Cinema Paradiso things that make me love movies and going to the movies and etc. 5 stars, from me. The rare, common bang. ADP 10 star. So it's time to do the show. You ready?
Let's do our little show.
I Love Gold. Matinee, a movie that is not like, if we didn't love it like we love it, we also probably would have forgotten about it the second Kenzo hits the stop record button. And I feel like it is often desperately underappreciated, especially from Joe Dante people who love this stuff. Like, what about this is not... Now, it is kind of a kid's movie, and it's got a lot of that... Like, anyway, all this to say, this is I Love Gold. This is the segment where we talk about the awards our movie won. Gold member loves gold. That's the deal. Joe Dante won the Silver Raven at the Brussels International Festival of Fantasy Film. Or BIFF. For short. And that's I Love Gold. That is the segment where we tie together the awards for the film. And speaking of tying together, now it is time for the Alan Parsons Project. This is the segment where we bring the movie into the Austin Powers trilogy. Who worked on what to bring who where? Could you believe that this is not the first time on Austin Pod this week we're talking about Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who are having an incredible week? And of course, one of their songs, I guess, is used in this film. But I also want to note that we'll be doing Flushed Away one day, thanks to them. So maybe Mia Vicino letterboxed, where are you? Do it, Flushed Away. Also, obviously, Jerry Goldsmith, who we talked about extensively, and Michelle Scobie, who worked on the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes and Big Fish, Burton's next film. So that's fun.
Hell yeah.
There you are. Yeah, over there.
We have one you over there. Our dear friend Sly Oswald wrote in and said, "Hey gang, sending this in last minute while I'm at the gym. Just wrapped up the Planet of 2001 Apes episode and heard you had no use over there. So here I am, over there. I remember Matinee coming out, but not much else. What's more important is to highlight..."
This is what America thought of Matinee at the time. I didn't see it. Anyway, and I think Jurassic Park probably had a lot to do with that. But anyway, Sully Oswald continues.
"What's more important to highlight is that Joe Dante gave the world's greatest sequel next to Dune Part 2. I'm talking about Gremlins 2, baby. I don't know if it's linked or not, but it has that big zany ADP energy and is an all-timer for me. Not to mention it gave us one of the most memorable Key and Peele sketches. It's one of my favorite Key and Peele sketches on the history of the planet. It's one of the greatest things probably to exist." Silly said, "Anyways, wanted to drop a quick letter before I go back to training my feeble body for a Spartan race this summer. Hugs and kisses,
oh,
Silly."
Oh, yeah.
Spartan race.
Silly does what? These races, man. Oh, yeah. Look this up. This is nuts. Silly Oswald, thank you for the letter, man.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I just say, like, in general, can I just plug, like, please, working out and, like, physical fitness? Look, I'm sorry, body positivity, I am morbidly obese, if people don't know, by the BMI scale, and so I feel like I have an authority to say I don't love it. I've never really loved it. And same. Working out and like soda, for example, which I love, as it turns out, unfortunately, is poison. And as my brain has taught me this week, did I ever love it? I don't know. So I just want to plug diet and exercise, two very important things that will make life really easy and fun.
I'm on the journey too. Been working out every day now.
It's good. Shout out. Hell yeah.
ADP is on a health journey 2024 as a unit.
ADP really is. The degree to which I am on a let me tell you.
It's great.
I've never wanted anything more in my life than sitting in a play Monday night and my stomach was like, you're going to get five guys after this. Huh? And I didn't do it.
Hell yeah.
To actually answer Silly Oswald's question, yes, Gremlins 2 is absolutely on the wheel. Yes, we will absolutely do it. That's really all I can say. We're going to have to do Gremlins first, which is a great film.
Hell yeah.
I think Gremlins is awesome. I think Gremlins 2 is like getting an old copy of Gremlins 1 from the library, like as a library book, and seeing it had been drawn all over in the margins and scribbled on or whatever. You haven't seen, have you seen Gremlins 2? You haven't.
I've never seen Gremlins or Gremlins 2. No.
Do you see, people? This is what we have to do. We have to go back.
I also want to shout out our friend Pat Healy, who just put through a review of Austin Powers International Man of Mystery and tagged us and said, literally this happened like 10 minutes ago. Glad I rewatched this as an adult so I can finally understand Austin Danger podcast. It's almost upsetting how Mike Myers clearly defined about half of my sense of humor as a child. I owe the other half to Jack Black. 4 stars and a heart. That's what we like to see, baby.
Love it. Thank you, Pat.
I just saw that on my In the VHS Village feed and I had to shout it out. But if you would like to write a review and tag it ADP or leave us a voicemail or a letter, the best way to have your voice be heard is always austindangerpodcast@gmail.com. Send them to us and we'll share them on the show.
That's right. But now it is time for me to spin the wheel.
Spin that wheel, Kev.
Oh, folks, this is somehow your first episode of Austin Danger Podcast. Of course, we are the only randomly curated Austin Powers podcast on the internet. And as a result, every week at this point in the show, a giant wheel comes down from either where I am or where Mackenzie is. We spin it and we pick the next week's movie. Kenzo, there's an actor who I really love. I love him as much as I love John Goodman, as much as I love Robin Williams, as much as I love any of my guys. I love this man and his work. And this is a movie that I'm fairly certain, I don't even know if you know what this movie is respectfully, just based on what I know of your knowledge of movies. You may have heard of the title. I don't know if you've seen it.
Okay.
This is a movie from our wheelhouse. It is almost exactly 1 year before Austin Powers came out. This film was released in 1996. What if I told you that this is a film? A couple weeks ago, you watched a movie with Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira.
Yes.
And of course, their son is named Ben, and he's done a whole bunch of different comedy things. But in the year 1996, he directed a film that famously flopped at the box office, but has become a cult classic, and actually was a cult classic pretty quickly in the VHS era. It stars, of course, that lovely, young, funny gentleman from In Living Color, James Carradine.
Yes, the film is
Cable Guy.
Okay, I have seen the poster a bunch for this movie of him with him making the weird face with the cable. I've seen that poster a bunch.
You know, and what better movie to discuss on a podcast than The Cable Guy, a movie we will be watching via AMC Plus or rental.
Wow. Janine Garofalo. Amazing. I do love her.
Yeah, this cast is crazy. Janine Garofalo, alt comic staple.
Love her.
The cast, the Wikipedia Black. Cast is unhinged.
Leslie Mann.
It's just a list of names. Yeah, the very canceled.
Matthew
Patrick. Oh, hang on. Enough of Andy Dick. No Andy Dick. But like Eric Roberts as himself. What is that?
Oh, Eric Roberts.
Austin Danger Podcast Hall of Famer. When we do the Dark Knight episode that January or whatever, that next year, he's going in the Hall of Fame, Eric Roberts.
Oh, my God. My God. We've got to do his weird movie. What are those weird series of movies that he does that you told me about? The fucking, what's it called?
Oh, Stalked by My Doctor?
Yes, Stalked by My Doctor.
We could do a month of Stalked by My
Doctor
if you want.
We have to do Stalked by My Doctor. Yeah, we should do the Stalked by My Doctor series.
If you thought the Angels in America coverage coming in June was a farewell to listeners, Stalked by My Doctor 4, Patient's Revenge. Good Lord. Good Lord. I couldn't even get through one of those, by the way. I watched it as a bit, and I could barely make my way through it.
I am going to pass out from laughing.
Next week at Austin Danger Podcast, we're covering a film the French would call Le Cable Guy. No, they wouldn't. They would probably call it Le Cable Guy. But until then, for Mackenzie, this is Kev. Austin Danger Podcast, peace.
If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at Austin Danger Pod. This episode was mixed and edited by me, Mackenzie. Thanks for listening.